Good morning, everybody. I'm going to call this meeting of the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. We have a quorum, and this is our Thursday, March 7th hearing. And all hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. This is not Thursday, March 7th.
The minutes are from
The minutes are from March 7th. Sorry about that. So do we have the minutes?
Mr. Chair, as I was reading through the minutes, I did notice the last bill about flying cars, very intriguing. So with that, though, I would move the approval of the minutes of March 7th.
Okay. Is there discussion and discussion to the notation? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the motion prevails.
Yes.
Okay. We have four bills today on the agenda, and we want to make sure that we're out of here on time. So we will ask testifiers and authors and those with questions to be crisp and noting our time. So our first bill is House File 3499. And would you like to move your bill, Representative Brand?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's my motion. I move the bill to the judiciary.
Okay. And I understand you have an amendment?
I do have an amendment that I'd like to attach to this bill as well.
Okay. Can you talk about the A1 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The amendment, the A1 amendment that I have offered today includes another bill. We have kind of a situation going on where judiciary is starting to see a lot of civil penalty type bills going to their committee, and of course with deadlines coming up, the chair asked that we condense two bills into one for ease and efficiency. And so since they're both going to go to judiciary at the same time, and they're both related to locomotives and train engineers and that sort of thing, we're going to combine them. So this bill actually is that's going to be amended onto the train link bill has a requirement for insurance, specifically a cost of $5 million. And of course there's a penalty with that, civil action penalty as well. So that's the amendment.
Okay, are there questions or discussion? Okay. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So to your bill as amended, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to take a moment just to kind of frame today, because these bills all have to do with railroad safety in one aspect or another. I want to start by setting the tone that these bills are both public safety and also worker safety as well. As we discuss the merits of each, please consider that public safety and worker safety apply not to just our individual districts, but rather across the entire state. In 2023, train derailments increased by 13.5% in Minnesota. That means we are headed in the wrong direction when it comes to both public policy and worker safety in Minnesota. I believe that these bills will reduce the risk of environmental harm and that of a potential endangerment to communities with rail lines passing through them. Now to the bill 3499. In the years since Joel Mueller first stepped into his first locomotive, trains have only gotten longer. 15,000 feet of train is quite a lot of product, metal, fuel, and other items included, but also a lot of potential for things to go wrong. In my district, trains are so long that they block portions of highway from Kasota to Mankato at the train yard and across several intersections along that way. This could sever the link between EMS and a patient in trouble, or in some cases, a larger than normal derailment, like what happened near Raymond, Minnesota last year. We might be familiar with Raymond, maybe not. That was a situation in which a piece of track broke, causing the derailment. There were several cars full of benzene, which is a known cancer-causing chemical. And according to a November 2023 WCCO report, months after the derailment, soil and groundwater continued to be contaminated with benzene. Also included in this bill, as we mentioned at the top when we amended the bill, is an update to 2010 statute covering a $5 million policy rather than a $1 million insurance coverage. Things cost more than they did in 2010. I mean, go to the grocery store and try to find anything that was the same price as it was 14 years ago. Costs associated with the crash also have gone up. Things like lost wages, lost ability to earn wages, medical bills, and worse. Nick, who will also be here to testify, can articulate exactly why acting now is in the best interest of the workers. So with that, I will turn my time over to testimony, and I'll be here to answer questions.
Thank you. First on our list is Joel Mueller. Again, welcome to the committee, Mr. Mueller, and you can keep your remarks around the 2 or 3 minute time frame. That would be great.
Sure. Chair Hornstein, members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Joel Mueller, and I'm with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. As Representative Brand has stated, train lengths now exceed 15,000 feet. When I began my career 28 years ago, train lengths averaged around 6,000 feet. As a locomotive engineer, every day I see the negative impact long trains have on Minnesota communities, cutting cities in half and blocking first responders from getting to those in need. Minnesota's rail infrastructure is not designed for trains of this size. Yards and terminals do not have the capacity to handle 2 to 3 mile long trains, which delays other trains waiting to arrive or depart those terminals. Most sidings in Minnesota's rail network are not big enough to handle the trains of this size and force other trains operate along that corridor to wait for hours at a time. It has been documented in Surface Transportation Board hearings that congestion within the rail network has frustrated rail customers due to poor service. This has caused rail customers to divert shipments to trucks, which are less efficient and lead to higher greenhouse gas emissions. Locomotive engineers are also reporting higher failures of equipment due to the extreme forces that the rail equipment is under. Poor placement of distributed power locomotives have added to these concerns. After several derailments involving long trains, the Federal Railroad Administration issued 2 safety advisories highlighting concerns with train length and train makeup. These documents advise railroads to amend their antiquated policies regarding train makeup and improve training for new and experienced locomotive engineers. I urge caution when considering the data and statistics the rail carriers will provide this committee. Training continues to be the bare minimum required under federal regulations. Train crews are often instructed to ignore company policies and procedures that take into consideration proper train makeup, allowing trains to depart their originating terminals that are not in compliance. When employees raise concerns of this practice, they face harassment and intimidation from railroad management. This tracks with news reports of the same experience railroad employees from other crafts, such as track inspectors and mechanical employees, have experienced. Considering railroads are struggling with a public image problem in regards to safety and derailments, one would think they would be actively pursuing solutions. Sadly, that is not the case. They are working hard to stop any congressional action or federal regulation. Railroad safety is stalled in Congress. The Federal Railroad Administration refuses to act on this issue. Following the Norfolk Southern derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, we have seen little action from rail carriers, the FRA, or Congress in the realm of rail safety. Do not be fooled by the carrier's argument that train length is federally preempted. This is the same argument we hear whenever we ask the state legislature to consider common sense railroad safety legislation. The Federal Railroad Safety Act is a relevant statute in the arena of train length, not the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act. Federal Railroad Safety Act gives states broad authority to regulate railroad safety where the federal government shall fall short. Neither federal regulators
nor Congress. You could wrap up, that would be helpful.
Pardon me?
Yeah, can you wrap up
your testimony? Oh, sure. Yeah, sorry. The carrier's attempts to downplay risks posed by their operations cannot go unchallenged, especially when the stakes are so high. This is common sense legislation rooted in industry best practices and would have very little impact on the railroad's bottom line. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Nicholas Kadich.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Will you be asking,
Mr. Chair, would you prefer questions at the very end after testimony?
Yes.
Thank you.
And that is why we want people to be very efficient in their testimony. Proceed. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Hornstein and committee members. My name is Nick Kadich, and I am the Minnesota Legislative Director for Smart Transportation Division, representing conductors, engineers, and yardmasters. And I'm kind of excited to be here for Railroad Day, so thank you for having me. The motor carrier language being added or added now to House File 3499 is pretty straightforward. Minnesota Statute 221.0255 is a great law protecting railroad workers. Some railroads have been encouraged by it since 2010 and moved into compliance voluntarily. But others boldly claim Minnesota law does not apply to them. This language adds enforcement penalties to the existing law in order to compel compliance from the offending railroad companies and raises a minimum insurance requirement to a more modern number. Railroad crews spend a lot of time in deadhead transportation, more than most people outside the industry think. This usually involves a railroad subcontracted crew hauling company. As railroads moved away from employing their own staff and vehicles to transport train crews, this statute became necessary to set a safety standard for what these contracted vehicles needed to be and the insurance requirements they had to carry. Railroad workers are not covered by worker compensation laws. They are part of the Federal Employers Liability Act, which is a fault-based system where an injured employee must sue the railroad and prove negligence. If an employee is injured while at work and the railroad did nothing wrong, the employee is entitled to nothing. This is why uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage is so important to us. The $1 million uninsured, underinsured motorist does not make sense in the year 2024, and it's a math problem. A crew van hauling a conductor, engineer, and a trainee, let's just say, is T-boned by a drunk driver who ran a red light. All the crew members in the van suffer career-ending injuries. The drunk driver was not insured. So here's the math problem. The engineer had 10 years to retirement, the conductor 20, and the trainee 30. At $75,000 a year, just the lost wages would be $4.5 million before we even consider the van driver or medical expenses. This insurance requirement protects railroad employees when they are passed off to the care of subcontractors by railroad companies. And I urge you to support this. Thank you very
much. Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Next, we have Amber Backus. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Certainly. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, the trade association representing four Class 1 and 14 regional and short line railroads who ship and deliver over 2 million carloads of commodities and goods safely and efficiently over 4,373 miles of railroad track. Safety is at the forefront of the operations of the railroad industry. And for the last 80 years, railroads have operated millions of trains exceeding 8,500 feet without incident. In fact, a recent report from the Alliance for Infrastructure and Innovation, an independent think tank, found that Federal Railroad Administration data on train accidents and crossing incidents does not provide strong evidence that increasing train lengths correlates with safety concerns as measured by train accidents. In fact, they posited that there may even be weak evidence to the contrary, that accidents continue to decline as trains increase in length. By limiting train length, as the bill does, there will be more trains needed to move materials and finished goods. The greater number of trains will interact more with the public at crossings, potentially leading to more accidents. And the Alliance for Infrastructure and Innovation report also noted that having more trains may also block crossings more often as they wait for the signal to enter rail yards or for another train ahead to clear the track or siding. And beyond increasing congestion on rail lines, more trains also means more fuel consumption and corresponding greenhouse gas emissions. For these reasons, we'd ask you to oppose the train length provisions. But since I have 2 minutes and we have two bills in ones, I'm going to quickly pivot to crew vans.
Okay.
And just speak to the provision regarding the increase in the minimum liability coverage for uninsured, underinsured policies. Current law in Minnesota for other carriers of people is a $50,000 coverage. The underlying bill's already at $1 million. That's 20 times more. Meanwhile, federal and state law requirements for passenger vans of 15 passengers or less is $1.5 million total financial responsibility. The underlying crew van bill is $6 million, and the amendment takes it to $10 million. I don't understand that rationale, and I also have a letter from the Insurance Federation of Minnesota stating that such coverage isn't available on the marketplace, which would make it impossible for us to find the crew vans needed to safely support the crews from the trains back and forth. So for those reasons as well, we would ask you to oppose that provision and suggest a referral to Commerce Committee too. So if there's a page that could pass out this letter from the Insurance Federation,
sure.
That would be helpful.
That'd be great. Thank you, Ms. Backus. Next we have Jason Colley. I hope you can correct my pronunciation if I did not get that correct. Okay. I stand corrected. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Jason Tahuli. My testimony reflects HF 3499 as introduced. I'm a certified locomotive engineer for Union Pacific Railroad. I was hired 29 years ago as a conductor, and today I'm the Director of Operating Practices and Rules in Union Pacific's Safety Department. Over the past 4 years, Union Pacific has tasked the Safety Department with many major initiatives, including reducing mainline FRA reportable derailments and blocked crossings. As a result, Union Pacific set records in both mainline reportable derailments and blocked crossing reduction in 2023. We accomplished these goals by using data and leveraging technology. Regarding derailment prevention, Union Pacific has developed Physics Train Builder, or PTB. PTB is technology that in real time simulates the physics of mass and movement, or what is referred to in the industry as in-train forces. Trains are like accordions. They expand and contract as they traverse the topography of the track. This expansion and contraction creates in-train forces known as buff and draft. Draft forces are pulling forces, while buff forces are squeezing forces. If these forces are not controlled, cars can be lifted out of the train causing derailment. PTB calculates the in-train forces before the train ever departs and as the train is tracked across the system. If the predicted forces are beyond our tolerance limits, an alert is created and sent to either our dispatch center or our yard controller so corrections can be made. Since the installation of PTB, Union Pacific has not experienced a single train makeup derailment or train length derailment using PTB. In conclusion, train size limitations will have no effect on derailment prevention as it will do nothing to control the physics associated with mass and motion. Managing these forces is the key to derailment prevention, not train length limitation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Travis. I'm not going to I'm 0 for 1 on Travis will state his name for the record, and we'll proceed.
Thank you. My name is Travis Owsley, and I represent the NSF Railway Company, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about House Bill 3499 and why we believe it may be unenforceable under federal law. For over a century, railroads have been subject to what the United States Supreme Court has described as one of the most pervasive and comprehensive schemes of federal regulatory schemes. In 1887, Congress created the very first federal regulatory agency to regulate railroads. Today, two federal agencies are principally dedicated to regulating railroads: the Surface Transportation Board, which has exclusive jurisdiction over rail transportation and how carriers operate their networks, and the Federal Railroad Administration, which seeks to ensure nationally uniform standards governing railroad safety. The purpose of these agencies and the body of federal law they enforce is to promote interstate commerce by ensuring a fluid national network free from a confusing patchwork of state and local laws. I want you to imagine a freight train carrying essential goods like seed and fertilizer or chemicals necessary for water treatment. That train begins its trip in California and travels the country in accordance with federal safety standards, but stops short of Minnesota to remove cars to comply with Minnesota law. Shipments are delayed and track capacity is taken up by cars waiting for another train to get to markets in Minnesota. Inventories run lower and Minnesota shippers incur greater expense to purchase or lease more cars to account for longer car cycles. This is the scenario that the Supreme Court had in mind when they ruled that state legislation mandating maximum train lengths was unconstitutional in 1945. Since then, no subsequent court ruling or congressional enactment has abridged this ruling. Indeed, the enactment of the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act of 1995 only reinforced this principle when it placed exclusive jurisdiction over rail operations with the STB. House Bill 3499 may be a well-intentioned effort by the state of Minnesota to address perceived safety concerns. However, it is also an effort by the state of Minnesota to regulate something that Congress and the courts have long said it may not, and therefore it would not withstand a legal challenge. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And finally, we have Larry Lloyd. Yes, I was confident on that one.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Larry Lloyd. I'm with Canadian Pacific Kansas City Railroad. I'm here to discuss and highlight our opposition to File 3499. Safety is a core principle at CPKC and foundational to everything we do. Operating safely is fundamental to our decision-making at every level of the company. It drives our disciplined operating practices, our capital investment, and our company culture. CPKC has invested consistently over time to enable the safe and efficient operation of long trains. Since 2013, our average train length has increased 28%, but our train accident frequency rate has decreased 45% during that time, from 1.8 to less than one incident per million train miles traveled. CPKC has a sophisticated train dynamic simulation process to support train and track design. Our electronic marshaling system verifies train builds based on length, tonnage, sequencing, and routing. The assertion that trains have increased up to 15,000 feet in many cases is simply not rooted in reality and not backed by data. CPKC limits our train length to 14,000 feet for distributed power and 10,000 feet for conventional operations. Our average intercity train length is 7,609 feet, nowhere near the claim of 15,000 feet. CPKC rules for manifest trains, trains that are made up of multiple types of freight, require speed and dynamic braking restrictions based on tonnage and operating territory. CPKC automatically monitors trains and train builds using automated simulators and continues to build out AI and algorithms. We have a diverse suite of wayside detectors that ensure the mechanical integrity of the equipment and actively monitor of engineering actions and operational alerts to ensure compliance. Our commitment to safe operation of longer trains doesn't just take into account their safe building and operation, though. Rather, CPKC's approach is holistic and strives to ensure minimal community impact while protecting our industry-leading Amtrak host relationship. Block crossings are mitigated through operational planning, controlled train meets, training and dedicated operating roles, and we take block crossing complaints very seriously and work to address each one we receive. CPKC has a strong relationship with Amtrak and has been its strongest host railroad year over year, earning us an A rating for on-time performance by Amtrak's own metrics. We are a host railroad on a number of Amtrak services and have made commitments to increase and initiate new Amtrak services, especially in Minnesota. CPKC's operations of longer trains do not interfere with our ability to be Amtrak's strongest host. Regardless, the legislation's negative impact to our customers, communities, and its negative impact to Amtrak service cannot be understated. If train lengths are arbitrarily limited, the detailed planning and data that goes into building trains to ensure that capacity is preserved will be impacted. A simple, artificial, and unscientific restriction on train length will lead to an increase in the number of trains on the network, which will lead to a less capacity for customer shipments, less capacity for Amtrak, and increased congestion for everyone else. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members, for your time.
Thank you so much. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And because this has gotten a little longer than I know anticipated, I'm not going to ask questions, but rather a few statements. You're going to be moving this to civil law?
Judiciary.
Judiciary. Yeah. So I would request a roll call for that.
Okay.
So that I don't forget to say that. Second of all, there's some parts of this bill that I think are actually good, and it's something we should be doing. You remember a few years ago we worked on this idea of getting crews back and forth to the rail engines and so forth. Unfortunately, there weren't any penalties for somebody that doesn't comply with that. So I think that part of it has some validity to that. But we've heard other testimony about the possibility of the liability cost and insurances and so forth. And we heard about the cost of loss of wages for the rail engineers and conductors and so forth. Unfortunately, what we didn't hear was the other liability issues that are related to it. So when somebody is still employed by a company, there's also work comp, there's long-term disability, there'll be Social Security if that's the case, that will also add on to the wages into the future. So we have to be cautious about just assuming that the limitation is there, because we don't know that all those circumstances are going to happen. In regards to train lengths as well, one of the things that I'm very much aware of is all businesses, no matter who it is, even trucking firms, have gotten longer trailers, gone to double trailers, and we have gotten skill levels up to the point of dealing with them. But what we do know is that, generally speaking, any business is going to be very leery about adding more risk to themselves as well. And so if some of these longer trains, some of them may be empty, meaning that they're not actually carrying any more weight, they're just longer, those are all things that we should be careful about dictating to a business that's controlling it, especially when we're understanding that this is a federal issue. It feels very much to me, this meeting, kind of directing and arbitrating between school board employee relations as well, between the unions and the school board, because it seems like this is more an issue that should be negotiated between the parties. And so I'm at requesting a no vote because I don't think it's quite ready. I think we have a lot of issues that are beyond this, and I think I think the next committee is going to have to struggle with those same issues, so I would recommend a no.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would just like to get a comment on the point that was raised about this being federally regulated and we can't do this. First I've heard of that.
Representative Brown.
To understand that.
Yeah, in preparation, I took a look at some of the laws surrounding preemption, and I know that in 1970, the federal government passed the Federal Railway Act, giving states broad authority to regulate railroad safety where the federal government falls short. And the federal government has not weighed in on train length yet. And so I want to make that abundantly clear that although there is preemption in certain cases, there's also a law in the books from 1970 saying that the states have the ability to do so if the federal government has not done anything to take action on these things. I do know that railroads, they've mentioned in their testimony about the preemption, and then also rail carriers in Minnesota, they're putting, honestly, we're talking about public safety again, so we're putting communities at risk when we're talking about these longer trains with more volumes of items. And so, although it is one of those questions where we talk about efficiency, and I understand everybody's trying to be more efficient over time, when we talk about logistics and moving things from coast to coast and from coast to the interior, it is important to note that there are limitations, and there should be limitations, I think.
Thank you. I think we have a representative from the railroads and then Representative Murphy, and then we'll do a roll call vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. To provide a little more detail on the point about how federal law governs train length, correct that there is not a statute specifically speaking to a maximum permissible train length. However, there is a U.S. Supreme Court directly on point on this issue, finding that state laws that seek to govern or limit train lengths is inconsistent and contravened by the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution. Second, the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act of 1995, while it doesn't speak specifically to train length in it, it does empower the STB, the Surface Transportation Board, with exclusive jurisdiction over rail operations, including scheduling, train operations, etc. And so while there's not a direct conflict preemption point here, there is a point of jurisdiction that the only agency that could come in and sort of do this would be the STB, pursuant to the jurisdictional statute in the ICTA. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment, there's a couple people talked about the safety already being there. The technology is following us, too, so that's important. But something that no one's really talked about is just the change to commerce. So I deal in agriculture. When it comes to grain and fertilizer, those are times of the year that we need to have the ability to move masses. And I see this as being a huge negative impact for agriculture. And even our energy, a lot of our energy follows the same, uses trains to be transported. And I think those could have an impact negatively on consumers. So I just want to make that point.
Thank you. And a final comment, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that was taken care of. I believe there was case law in regards to an Arizona law that tried to prohibit train length that was struck down by the Supreme Court as well. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Brand, would you like to renew your motion? Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, so are these kind of issues things that we'll delve into more in judiciary?
Yeah.
Okay.
Some of the ones around preemption, et cetera.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Brand,
yep,
your motion.
I renew my motion to bring this bill forward to judiciary. I ask for a green vote today for more than just public safety, but also for worker safety as well.
So the motion is to have House File 3499, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And there is a roll call having been requested.
Chair Hornstein.
Aye.
Chair Hornstein. Aye. Vice Chair Tabke.
Aye.
Vice Chair Tabke. Aye. Lee Petersburg.
No.
Lee Petersburg. No. Representative Brand.
Aye.
Representative Brand. Aye. Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins, aye. Representative Fogelman.
No.
Representative Fogelman, no. Representative Hudella.
No.
Representative Hudella, no. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Cagle, aye. Representative Kraft.
Aye.
Representative Kraft, aye. Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Murphy, no. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nelson, aye. Representative Norris.
Aye.
Representative Norris, aye. Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Olson, no. Representative Centimura.
Aye.
Representative Centimura, aye. Representative West.
No.
Representative West, no. Mr. Chair, the ayes are 9. The nays are 6.
Okay. Thank you very much. You're on your way to judiciary.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3798. Also Representative Brand.
Yeah.
This bill, it looks like you are referring to the General Register.
Yes, that's my motion for this piece of legislation.
This is one going to 90.
Proceed.
Okay, thank you. So in the event of a release of oil or another hazardous substance, a railroad company would be required under this bill to report the incident immediately to the fire department through a 911 emergency service. Previously, what's written now is that the railroad company would have to locate the specific fire chief for that jurisdiction, probably Googling it or whatever, however you would do it in an emergency real quick, and actually would, you know, in process slow things down instead of speed them up. So when we're talking about a situation where there is a derailment, time is of the essence, and I would ask for a green vote on this bill, and I will turn it over to anybody that wants to testify on this bill.
Anyone from the audience that wishes to testify? We didn't get anyone ahead of time, but okay. We'll have quick audience testimony and then Representative Petersburg. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Daniel Cryer. I'm the state fire marshal. And I want to thank Representative Brand for authoring this bill. So this was some information we received in my office. My office oversees the state teams. And those state teams include hazardous materials response teams who would be responding in the event there is an incident involving a rail derailment or a spill or any emergency in that regard. Input from the emergency managers for the railroad companies has asked that they'd like a more efficient way. So they'd like to be able to make contact to the emergency responders, but it's a lot easier to route it through the PSAP, the 911 dispatch center, versus having to have a long list of who's the fire chief in every community and who's the emergency manager in every community. So this proposal is going to look to create that efficiency and to make sure that there's timely response for an emergency. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and Representative Brand. We're on the same page on this one. So this is a great opportunity. During an emergency, we would love to have the railroads be dealing with having to deal with the emergency itself rather than having to track down everything. 911 has the experience to do so. It's a good bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Petersburg. Any further discussion? Okay. Would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I renew my motion that this bill go to the General Register where we can pass it off on the floor. And I would say, just as an added thing, please sign on. Make this bill bipartisan. This one is one that I think everybody wins.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Next, we have House File 4356, Representative Rand.
Yes. So this bill is a little bit of a different change in, I'm sure, conversation as well. This legislation
moved to Ways and Means.
Yes, I'm sorry. I make the motion that this bill be moved to Ways and Means.
Okay, proceed. Okay.
This legislation creates a definition for yard master. Right now, there's no current statute recognizing yard master as a profession. It also creates a length of shift parameters. So I know that this conversation will go something like this at some point today. We'll be talking about this being a way that we are going to get between bargaining rights, collective bargaining rights of the employees and, you know, the train companies that operate in the state of Minnesota. But I will say that this job, this classification of job, is a very important job. In the event of emergency, yard masters are the point of contact for EMS and first responders. They provide information about where those hazardous materials are, because their job is essentially to do things like inventory the chemicals and the materials coming in on rail cars and putting them in certain locations for the next part of the movement of the rail. And also, they coordinate these materials when they're on site. So it's a really important job. But when a person is asked to work 16 hours at a time, there, I think, could be some really compelling arguments that it's not just us talking about getting between the company and the employee. This is a matter of public safety. This is a matter of worker safety for the people who are working on site. And so I want to turn over the testimony, and I'll be here to answer questions after.
Okay. Mr. Kinnich.
Hello again, Chair Hornstein and committee members. My name is Nick Kadich, and I am the Legislative Director for Smart Transportation Division in Minnesota.
Proceed.
House File 4356, Yardmaster Hours of Service, is a bill with minimum impact to railroad companies, but a large effect on our communities and workers. It would close a gap in hours of service regulation not addressed by federal law. Yardmasters are employees who control all aspects of a rail yard. They also coordinate with first responders and are the point person in the event of an accident. They are very busy on the phone, answering emails, texting, and on the railroad radio. Since train crews are not allowed to carry cell phones, the radio is their only way to communicate and must be monitored at all times. It's a busy job. It's always been a busy job. As technology has advanced, yardmasters have seen a change in duties, but not a reduction in workload. The responsibilities have grown to include more rail yards after railroad companies have consolidated territories, and now yardmasters are in charge of more than one location at a time. So now we kind of know how busy and stressful the job is. Let's talk about the real risk to our state. Our communities and cities are built around rail yards. They're at the heart of small towns like Waseca and Proctor, and strung out through Minneapolis and St. Paul. Within these rail yards, you can find any commodity transported through our state, including the hazardous ones. In the event of any kind of accident or incident in a rail yard, the yardmaster directs the emergency response and communicates with all the people working in the rail yard to get everyone to safety. They alert the town or city to the danger, which could involve chlorine, anhydrous ammonia, or non-odorized propane. When a yardmaster is working a regularly scheduled 8-hour shift, this isn't an issue for them. The problem and driving force behind this bill is the yardmasters are being forced to work unplanned and unscheduled 16-hour or more shifts for multiple days in a row. My members are telling me how concerned they are about their abilities to react properly and do their job when fatigued like this. Staffing cuts by railroad companies have put them in a position where they can't cover all their yardmaster shifts. If one person goes on vacation, attends a company meeting, or calls in sick, it can force the 16-hour scenario to play out. It's widely accepted in the transportation industry, from planes to trucks to trains, that 12 hours is the maximum anyone should work in a safety-sensitive position. I do want to touch real quick on railroad collective bargaining. I don't think that should be a concern of this legislative body. As representatives of your communities, this is your chance to have a voice for how your communities are protected. You do not have a seat at the collective bargaining table, and legislating a standard that sets a cap on how many hours yardmasters can work and still function in their jobs is within your authority. So this bill affects a small section of railroad employees in our state, but has a very large impact in our communities, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kadich. Next, Amber Backus.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. Amber Backus on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. When Mr. Kudich brought this bill to our attention, each railroad checked internally, as none had heard complaints about yardmaster schedules. In fact, several received the opposite reaction, that the yardmasters appreciated the opportunity to earn extra income through optional overtime. And let me stress that again, optional overtime. The railroads can't force anyone to work overtime. And we agree that these positions are very important in running a railroad, but they are not directly involved in the movement of trains along the rail line, which is why current federal hours of service laws do not include them. The yardmaster is acting as a conduit, working from an office and transferring directions and instructions from management to the employees on the ground. In many cases, yardmaster tasks are shared with multiple management employees, ensuring the efficient operations of our rail yards. However, if a yardmaster were to engage directly in an activity on the ground that involves the movement of a train during their shift, the federal hours of service would apply. But unlike ground service employees, the vast majority of yardmasters work a set shift with set days off, reducing fatigue concerns. Typically, these are eight-hour shifts, and the yardmasters work less hours in a month than Captain Abel. But more importantly, I'd again ask you to look at the data. An FRA study found that 99.8% of all train accidents were attributable to personnel other than yardmasters, and of the 0.2% attributable to yardmasters, zero were proven to be related to fatigue. Imposing hours of service restrictions on all yardmasters engaged in all activities is impractical and unnecessary. Work schedules and hours of work are already addressed in current regulations and railroad collective bargaining agreements. This bill would not increase the safety or efficiency of our railroads. Instead, it would force railroads to hire excess people who would only be used intermittently, which is a challenge in this labor market. And for these reasons, we'd ask you not to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And next we have Travis Owsley. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the first federal hours of service laws for railroad employees were enacted by Congress in 1907, and hours of service has been governed by federal law since. The Federal Railroad Administration is the agency charged with enforcing the hours of service laws, and the FRA takes a functional approach as opposed to a status-based approach to determining who is subject to the laws and when. So in other words, there are not conductor hours of service. There are not locomotive engineer hours of service. Instead, when an employee is involved in a train operation, such as operating a locomotive or lining switches for movement, he or she is performing train service, covered service. When an employee is providing main track authority through radio or electronic transmission, he or she is performing dispatcher covered service. So when yard masters are performing those activities, they are covered by the hours of service laws. And this is what's reflected in the FRA Hours of Service Compliance Manual. Here, the legislation would seek to create a new category of hours of service regulation based on a yardmaster's job as opposed to the functional approach contemplated by the hours of service laws, and so would be in conflict with federal law. Second, the Supreme Court has ruled that states can't regulate issues traditionally addressed through collective bargaining pursuant to the Railway Labor Act. Hours of service has been a key element of railroad labor negotiations for over a century. By imposing specific hour limits, the state would essentially disrupt established bargaining processes. So whether due to the conflicts the bill would create within the federal regulatory scheme or the imposition on collective bargaining relationships governed by the RLA, this bill too would be preempted by federal law. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And that concludes our testimony, unless there are other members of the audience. Member discussion, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is to anybody that might know the answer, but I believe it's true that the hours of service for yardmasters is negotiable through labor contract negotiations. Is that correct?
Mr. Kadich.
Chair Hornstein and Representative Petersburg, would you please say your question again for me?
Sure. What you're seeking for is control over the number of hours for yardmasters. Is that not part of negotiable through labor negotiations when the contracts are up?
I believe anything is possible through negotiation. However, there aren't any caps at this point on yardmasters' general duties. And while a statement was made where overtime is not mandatory, I would call that false. When a railroad employee shows up to work, they are a captive of the railroad until released. And so overtime is not an option for us.
Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. And I appreciate that because I think so. I agree with you. I think it is a negotiable item. And you said something early in your testimony that says we should not be involved with collective bargaining issues, which I again agree that we should not be. And I think this puts us squarely in the middle of that when it's already available for you to discuss that with your people and with the railroads. If we start micromanaging labor negotiations this way, we're going to open up a whole can of worms with every other industry that may choose to want to go around the labor negotiations and collective bargaining process. So I think this is a dangerous precedent to set when we are saying, hey, we need to control the number of hours that companies have with their contracts, especially when it is a union employed. And unions have the ability to make those negotiations anyway. And we also know that there's some issue in regards to what federally or not we can do. So I think it's a dangerous bill. I would recommend no one. And I think this is important enough for us to also have a roll call, please.
Okay. Roll call is requested. Additional discussion. And would the author like to respond?
Yeah, I'd like to respond a little bit to that. I think that when we're talking about human beings that are working 16-hour days, dealing with potentially hazardous chemicals in the center of a community, I think that falls squarely outside of just collective bargaining rights. I think that that is something that you'll see that there are some support letters from communities across the state, ones that we represent that are also calling this is more than just a collective bargaining situation. I will tell you that yardmasters do not have federal hours of service classifications now, which means this bill is not preempted by federal law. Also, I should mention the fact that the transportation industry has widely accepted a 12-hour as a maximum cap, but there's nothing written in law to say that. And I think it's also important to point out the exact duties of a yardmaster include all movements of trains within the yard, switching and classification of rail cars, coordinating with maintenance of way employees working in the rail yard, coordinating with mechanical employees repairing or inspecting rail cars, coordinating with locomotive shops and the movement of locomotives, coordinating non-railroad employees working in the rail yard, managing location inventory of all rail cars and the commodities, including hazardous materials, acting as a liaison between all parties and crafts working in the rail yard, answering calls from customers, and acting as a liaison between railroad management, customers, and workers, plus calling the coordination with first responders in the event of an accident or incident.
Yeah.
I think this is too much to expect one person to be doing 16-hour days to work for. That's too many responsibilities to also be tired.
Okay. Thank you for that. Any further discussion before we take a roll call vote? All right. We are voting on House File 4356.
Chair Hornstein.
Aye.
Chair Hornstein. Aye. Vice Chair Tapke.
Aye.
Vice Chair Tapke. Aye. Lead Petersburg.
No.
Lead Petersburg. No. Representative Brand.
Aye.
Representative Brand. Aye. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Elkins. Aye. Representative Fogelman.
No.
Representative Fogelman. No. Representative Fidella.
No.
Representative Fidella. No. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Cagle, aye. Representative Kraft,
aye.
Representative Kraft, aye. Representative Murphy,
no.
Representative Murphy, no. Representative Nelson,
aye.
Representative Nelson, aye. Representative Norris,
aye.
Representative Norris, aye. Representative Olson,
no.
Representative Olson, no. Representative Senator Mira,
aye.
Representative Senator Mira, aye. Representative West,
no.
Representative West, no. Mr. Chair, the ayes are 9, the nays are 6.
Thank you very much. So, actually, the motion was for House File 4356 to go to Ways and Means, mm-hmm. and you are on your way to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
So we have one more bill on the agenda, members. House File. Oh, keep forgetting to gavel. House File 4357 is our last bill on the agenda. And the motion here, Representative Brand, is also Ways and Means, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep, so I move that this bill, House File 4357, be moved out of committee onto Ways and Means.
Okay, so to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the last bill we'll be up to talk about today, and we're going to bring this locomotive into the station on time, I hope. So we've all heard about wayside rests, but wayside detectors are a little bit different. These automatic scanners would be placed under the bill at every 10-mile interval or up to 15 miles interval if there's a challenging topography in the way along the track. Scanning, so what they do is they scan for dragging equipment and elevated temperatures, the wheels and the bearings, which are indicators of imminent catastrophic failures and can cause derailments. Sounds like something that we should really focus on when we're talking about public safety, but also worker safety. They have the ability to communicate with train crews via radio broadcast and have a direct link to the applicable railroad dispatching center as well. Why does this matter? Over a year ago, a derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, resulted in a major incident of over 100,000 gallons of hazardous material catching on fire. There were workers that were injured, and the communities involved were told that they could not return to their homes for over 6 days. Following the disaster, the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, called upon railroads to join the C3RS, or Confidential Close Call Reporting System, to collect data on near misses and to weaknesses in our current rail system. All Class 1 railroads have agreed to join in Minnesota, but have not done so until today at the time of this testimony. Currently, wayside detectors are unregulated by the federal government, and states have the authority to act. With that, I will turn it over to testifiers, and I'll be here to answer your questions after.
Okay. Nicholas Kadich is our first testifier.
Hello again, Chair Hornstein and committee members. Nick Kadich with Smart Transportation Division, representing conductors, engineers, and yardmasters. I'm happy to testify in favor of House File 4357, Wayside Detector Systems. Following the derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, there's been a great appetite to enhance rail safety in this country, especially where railroads intersect our communities. Wayside detectors are essentially a continuing safety inspection happening every time a train passes, checking for defects known to cause derailments. This continuing inspection has become more important as we see mass layoffs of the experienced inspectors and their duties placed on train crews who are only trained to perform a fraction of the requirements FRA places on mechanical employees. When notified of a defect, the train crews safely stop the train at a location not blocking public road crossings and inspect the defect from the ground. This traditionally means the conductor walks back with some basic tools and reports their findings to the railroad dispatching center. The defect is either repaired in place or the car removed from the train. So within this bill are two very key pieces. First, the requirement for railroads to place and maintain wayside detectors, making the current optional program mandatory. Second, the bill requires the train be stopped and inspected. The current railroad practice is to keep the trains moving and then inspect at a forward location, which can mean well over 100 miles of running a train through communities with a known defect. This practice by the railroads is a key driver why this bill is so necessary. Detectors that are ignored are useless, just like taking the batteries out of your smoke alarm.
Wayside detectors in this bill do more than prevent derailments. A warm wheel may also indicate a sticking brake, which is a very easy repair for a train crew. This sticking brake is not likely to cause a derailment, but can easily set fires along the railroad tracks, which, as we've seen in dry weather, can spread out of control quickly. Stopping to inspect the train and repair defects like this should be required of railroads to protect the public and our Minnesota landscape. This style of detector was advertised by railroads as a way to replace train crew members previously riding in a caboose, observing the train from the rear for smoking wheel bearings or other defects. This has not been lived up to by railroad companies, and in places where there was success, the decision by railroads not to stop and inspect their trains for defects is a literal disaster waiting to happen. Statements made by railroads about what they're working towards should be treated with caution. I would say they are still working toward implementing the original detector plan 40 years later and have come up short. And I ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Amber Backus. Welcome back.
Yes, good morning again, Mr. Chair. Amber Backus with the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association. And I'm sorry, I have to disagree with Mr. Kadich's testimony. The events in East Palestine were incredibly tragic, and the railroads did take an intense look at the detector system, and there's now a new standard in place where they're reviewing 150 different algorithms from all different kinds of detectors to figure out when a train should be stopped. And maybe that's one of the initial shortfalls of this bill. We do have thousands of data-driven detectors across Minnesota, but they use 12 technologies, including temperature, acoustics, sonics, machine vision systems. And all these technologies together enable precise identification of equipment defects and are selected in place based on the most effective type for each location. The bill before you requires installation of two specific types of detectors using an arbitrarily chosen mileage standard. There is no data behind this approach. Mandating specific detectors in arbitrary locations diverts resources from strategically placing detectors where they're truly beneficial. This will prevent railroads from investing in new technologies with potentially greater safety benefits, meaning the bill. And then furthermore, the bill requires all these mandated detectors to be installed in less than 9 months' time. The regional and short line railroads do not have the capital to fund these installations and will need to raise prices on crop fertilizer, ethanol, and other customers to cover the cost of this mandate. And there is a letter in your packets from impacted shippers concerned about this. Additionally, the tight time frame will disrupt current freight movement on all railroads and add delays for Minnesota's agribusiness, mining, and manufacturing as they move their products to global markets. And with me today, we have representatives of all the railroads, the short lines, and the class ones, who will speak to the unintended consequences of mandating this arbitrary standard, the increased cost for railroad shippers, and the conflicts with federal law and regulations. MRRA members are happy to work with you on solutions to address specific safety challenges, but an arbitrary requirement that diverts resources from data-driven and proven responses is not in anyone's best interest, and we'd ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. And before we get to Mr. Wagner, I forgot that I had Mr. Mueller on the list, so we'll have Mr. Mueller and then Mark Wagner, Jason Tolley, and Larry Lloyd, and others.
Morning, Chair, members of the committee. Joel Mueller with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. I'm not going to reiterate any more about East Palestine. We all know what happened there. What I would like the committee to understand is that while the railroads are claiming that they're setting a baseline of 15 miles between installed defect detectors, it's important to note that they're not hitting that baseline. There's a rail corridor across southern Minnesota that is a primary route for shipping ethanol. It's 108 miles long. There's only one wayside defect detector along that entire route. This is a huge gap in safety along that corridor. Also within the industry, we have heard the rail carriers discussing trending analysis rules, absolute temperature requirements, but this information is not available to the employees in the field. We're often left unaware when a wheel in their train is trending hot. According to the MTSB preliminary report regarding the East Palestine disaster, the wheel that caused the derailment registered a temperature of 103 degrees above ambient temperature at a wayside defect detector 20 miles prior to the accident. The crew never received any notification of this. This is far below the 170-degree stop and inspect standard the industry says they're using. Again, I will reiterate, the railroads are actively working to ensure the federal government does not act on this issue. While the Federal Railroad Administration has established a Railway Safety Advisory Committee to consider regulation on wayside defect detectors, no action has been taken. Final rulemaking is likely years away. This bill is a step in the right direction to the common sense railroad safety that protects workers, the environment, and the communities. And I want to thank you again for allowing me to speak.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Mark Wagner. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Wagner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Mark Wagner, President, CEO of Twin City and Western Railroad. We do not have any wayside detectors on our railroad. We're a short line railroad. We maintain the main line at 40 miles an hour. We operate our manifest trains at 30, and any train that has hazmat in it, we operate it at 25 miles an hour. We also have two dedicated trained rail car inspectors that inspect each train, and also these ethanol trains that we originate are inspected thoroughly at origin before we move them. So it would be a tremendous capital burden on us as a short line because we do not have the ability to raise our revenues because we're competing with trucks and our Class 1 partners. Our division of revenue for our movements is not high. So basically, if this is mandated, that will take away resources that we use to keep the track itself to that 40-mile-an-hour standard in that redundancy. So we would ask that this bill not be approved. I would like to note, though, that as part of the Southwest Light Rail project, which we happen to be the freight railroad involved in it, as part of the discussions with Met Council, they will be installing a defect detector at the junction of the where we junction with BNSF in just west of downtown Minneapolis, and then another one on the Eden Prairie Minnetonka border. And that's part of the Southwest project. Met Council is paying for that. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Jason Tolley.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Jason Tahuli. I'm the Director of Operating Practices and Rules at Union Pacific Railroad. I would like to thank the House Transportation Committee for the attention on rail safety, though I rise in opposition to House File 4357 regarding wayside detector systems. Some overall observations to begin. As technology has advanced, so have incredible leaps in the rail industry safety performance. Since the early 1970s, accident rates have fallen 80%. The Union Pacific team since 2004 has reduced employee personal injuries by 36%, and we have reduced derailments by 15%. While these reductions are due in large measure to the diligence of the company's hardworking employees, technology has aided in this advancement. Wayside detector technology of various types, such as hot bearing, acoustic bearing, hot wheel, dragging equipment, high wide, even radiation detectors, have been deployed across the system for decades voluntarily by the industry. Each year, more are installed, such as the 80 to 100 hot bearing detectors being installed this year at Union Pacific. Union Pacific averages less than 17 miles between detectors. Railroads and the Federal Railroad Administration have agreed to install additional detectors to achieve an average of 15 miles. By 2025, Union Pacific will have slightly less than 15 miles between detectors within range of the policy proposed. But the proposal to publicly disclose device locations and functional details competes with transportation security priorities. Referencing the subject of defect notifications, Union Pacific has a robust rules and procedures in place for how a crew should respond to alerts from wayside detectors. When a detector has provided notification, a UP mechanical responder on the ground will make the safest overall decision if repositioning a car is needed to safely perform the repair, for example, if it's stopped on a bridge or in a tunnel. Flexibility should be allowed to move the defective car to a safe location for immediate repair. In conclusion, the bill would require railroads to install wayside detectors on their networks at intervals that the state of Minnesota has dictated. But the construction and operation of railroad facilities is one of the explicit items on a list of federal law to prevent states from regulating. Wayside detector advances, guided by science and evidence, and not arbitrary factors, are making the railroad safer. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you, Mr. Tahuli. Next, we have Larry Lloyd.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the committee.
Welcome back.
Yep, thank you so much. So again, I'm Larry Lloyd on behalf of Canadian Pacific Kansas City Railway. I want to express our concerns with file 4357. So as I mentioned before, safety is a core principle at CPKC. It's foundational to everything we do. As I mentioned before, our capital investments in the last 10 years have increased 45%, driving down our train accident rate 45% to less than one incident per million track miles. We also reinvest about 20% of our revenue back into the business every year, and 60% of that is directed exactly towards safety and replacement initiatives that ensure our network remains safe and efficient. It is with that industry-leading safety record and fine eye towards significant capital investment and innovation that we oppose 4357. Mandating specific types of detectors in arbitrary locations demonstrates that there is no science, engineering, or understanding of railroad safety infrastructure behind this legislation. CPKC uses a variety of technologies to predict and prevent incidents. Our suite of diverse wayside detectors, nearly all fielded voluntarily, includes acoustic bearing detectors, broken rail detectors, dragging equipment detectors, hot box detectors, trunk hunting detectors, wheel impact load detectors, and wheel profile detectors. CPKC's investment in wayside technology over the past two decades exceeds $200 million. And the key with all those detectors is the vast majority of them are predictive, not reactive, unlike the detectors that are in this bill. CPKC monitors detector performance using a series of automated rules. Those rules are dependent based on our various suite of detector types, something that 4357 again does not take into account. The result is that CPKC's wayside detectors are extremely effective at finding defects. Our remote safety inspection process uses a combination of in-office remote safety inspectors, train inspection portal systems, wayside detectors, and advanced algorithms. The RSI process does not eliminate the human inspector from the visual inspection. In fact, over the past 7 years, CP has hired almost 200 additional full-time qualified railcar inspectors to advance repair. Our remote safety inspection process greatly assists those employees in doing field-based inspections and identifying defects. The process has resulted in this. 93% of defects for rolling bearing defects are detected in advance. 85% of all air brake defects related to repairs are driven by our cold wheel detectors. And we have from this reaction, a 95% reduction in defects identified by hot box detectors preemptively since CPKC deployed our use of acoustic bearing detectives along with our patented data and analytical algorithm. Train and engine employees, the folks that drive the train, are not experts in mechanical defects. Relying on untrained personnel, which is what 5347 would force the industry to do, to judge a bearing in the field would only open up the rail network to increase risk, when everything we do and what we need you to help us in doing is aimed at reducing risk. CPKC has a health monitoring system for detectors to ensure that missed alerts do not occur. If a detector issues a false alert, CPKC will have a qualified employee check the detector and repair it. 99.9% of our detectors are working at any given time. That is not an estimate. That is our standard. In conclusion, CPKC firmly concurs with our other Class 1 testifiers that 5347 is wading into areas covered by federal law, which undermines the national uniformity in terms of rail safety and interstate commerce. If passed into law, 5347 would unnecessarily handcuff CPKC's implementation of rail safety measures that have always been and need to continue to be specifically tailored and responsive to the varying situations and dynamic environments that our industry encounters 24/7, 365. With that, I appreciate again your time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much. Do we have any further testimonies? Travis Owsley. Welcome back.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, committee. At BNSF, we are proud to have voluntarily introduced thousands of wayside detectors across our network. The detectors and our continued focus on safety is working. In 2023, BNSF had our safest year ever with our lowest injury frequency rate in the company's 175-year history. Our work in safety is never done, and we are committed to continuous improvement in safety, including in building out and refining our detector network. Even so, and apologies for sounding like a broken record here, but the bill does raise concerns in that it conflicts with federal law. First, the construction and operation of railroad facilities and the operation of trains are under the exclusive jurisdiction of the STB. And second, the FRA already enforces a comprehensive body of regulations concerning the inspection and operating condition of rolling stock. Moreover, As my colleague from the BLET mentioned, the FRA is actively evaluating the issue of wayside detectors within its Railroad Safety Advisory Committee. What the RSEC is the FRA's means of collaborative rulemaking in which it brings in input from all stakeholders, railroads, the labor organizations that represent railroad workers, state rail safety agencies, and equipment manufacturers. The RSEC has been charged with developing recommendations for regulations and technical standards governing wayside detectors. So in short, the FRA has fully occupied the space concerning rail equipment health, and any state regulation in this regard would only conflict and confuse the nationally uniform scheme of regulation governing this area. And that is why we believe this legislation would also be preempted under federal law. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, again, is another situation where I think the industry actually knows better than the legislature on how to protect themselves. And we're hearing all sorts of different anecdotal information about it. And I, for one, am just as important, feel just as important about the safety of everybody around. And yet we are developing technologies that go far beyond what we had years ago. Matter of fact, even personnel is becoming more and more specialized in what they are doing and responsible for, as indicated by the fact that people on the ground have a lot more opportunities to register and develop analysis based upon many different detectors, not just these wayside detectors, so that they may be very much better able to understand what is going on. However, I also agree that better communication is always important, and I would think that even having the person up in the train engine being aware of what's going on would be helpful, and so I think there's a lesson to be learned there, that transparency and in information is also a benefit for us to move that forward, and I think that's important too. However, one size fits all based upon just an arbitrary figure for where these are put is something that I think we should stay away from and allow the industry to actually determine what is the best for that and not just creating something out there. So I would certainly recommend that this continue to be worked on, but I know it's moving forward, and I'm going to ask for a roll call on this one too.
Okay.
Chair.
Roll call is requested and granted. Are there other comments, questions? Representative Brandt.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the robust testimony and robust conversation today about this bill. I think I would say a couple things about track detectors is that these will also help in the detection of and hopefully the stop of wildfires. And I know that we had a wildfire east of where I serve, where I live, and I think Representative Petersburg's district, about 1,000-acre wildfire, and it wasn't caused by a railroad, but it's important to note that firefighters, and especially in my area of the world, do not have wildland fire training. And as a result, there were some injuries that happened because firefighters are being asked to participate in wildland fires. They don't necessarily have the training or the tools to do it, They're just doing what they can to protect human life and also buildings and structures, that sort of thing. I think as we start getting closer to drier climate conditions in Minnesota, the incidence of more wildfires is likely. And so I think this is another opportunity for us to do better for our state. We heard testimony today, one track detector for 108 miles. Some tracks have no detectors. I think that we can do better and we should do better, and this is an opportunity to do better, both for public safety and for worker safety. So with that, I ask for a green vote.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, roll call vote. So this is the motion that House File 4357 be referred to Ways and Means, and the committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Hornstein.
Aye.
Chair Hornstein. Aye. Vice Chair Tapke.
Aye.
Vice Chair Tapke. Aye. Lee Petersburg.
No.
Lee Petersburg. No. Representative Brand.
Aye.
Representative Brand. Aye. Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Elkins. Aye. Representative Fogelman.
No.
Representative Fogelman. No. Representative Fudella.
No.
Representative Fudella. No. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Representative Cagle. Aye. Representative Kraft.
Aye.
Representative Kraft. Aye. Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Murphy. No. Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Nelson. Aye. Representative Norris.
Aye.
Representative Norris. Aye. Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Olson. No. Representative Sensenmura is excused. Representative West.
No.
Representative West. No. Mr. Chair, the ayes are 8, the nays are 6, with one excused.
There being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. So, members, thank you. That concludes our agenda for today. We'll have more bills on Thursday at 8:30. And any announcements from you, your side? Okay. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, members.